Good morning, Leonie. How are you?
I'm just sneezing, Andy. Sorry about that.
You know, I had the very same thing. I came back to the computer and suddenly, noises off, basically. But yours would have been more elegant than mine.
I think
Mouse.
I fear not. I fear not. How are
Well,
you, apart from that?
much the better for hearing your dulcet tones, my dear. Mal is joining us in a second. Yeah, literally a couple of days ago, suddenly the storm passed, and I thought, I can see, I can breathe. I could just about see, actually. The rug needs a bit of a dressing at the weekend. But yeah, much better, thank you. I hope you've had a decent week.
It's been quite the week, really. It's been quite a sad week, actually. I'm very sad about to hear about Alistair Darling.
I was going to say, in the celestial bar, Henry Kissinger, Alistair Darling, Shane
Yeah,
McGowan.
I know. Quite the week.
Isn't it just? I mean, Mal, good morning.
Morning.
How are you, sir?
I'm okay.
Marvellous,
I'm trying to
marvellous.
stay awake.
Thank you very much. I think that makes three of us possibly. Leonie and I were just sneezing off mic, so to speak. Hopefully you're not.
No, I'm okay from that point of view, touching wood.
Yeah, marvellous. Okay, resilience, order of the day. So we started basically Alistair Darling having passed, Henry Kissinger having passed. Graham's with us in a second, and Shane McGowan. Quite an odd sort of gathering at the Celestial Bar. Leonie, did you want to lead off on that with Alistair Darling? Did you know him?
Yes, I did. I wouldn't say, I knew him intensively, but I had met him a few times. And just before the 97 general election, I was with him during the it was in the short campaign, actually. And I was driving him around in a car, and we were
Lucky him.
Yes, my driving's not too bad, so it wasn't too awful from that perspective. And one of the things that I said to him was, well, obviously you'll be bound to be expected to shave your beard off. And of course, he was very strenuous in his denials that the beard was ever going to have to go. And
It eventually did.
I think it was more than eventually. I think within 1 week
Yeah.
of May 1997, the beard was gone. And I don't think it ever came back, actually. But yeah, there aren't that. I'm not a big beard fan, but he did actually
Well,
look
thank you for bearing with me in that respect. Yes. Yeah. Usually can't see it. There's not. Yeah.
But he did look good with the beard, but then he looked fine without the beard as well. So yeah, I just particularly remember that conversation because it was terribly funny. Because less than a week, I'd say, after the election, the beard was gone forever.
That strikes me as the indication of a man who very wisely listens to the women who care about him, and it listens perhaps therefore more generally to the ogres around him. And I mean, amongst other things, he'll be remembered, I guess, for steering us through the 2008 crash.
Much more seriously, I think he is much underrated, and Gordon Brown too, for the work that they did in basically saving not just us, but I think the global economy. If you think back to that time, I mean, the Tories ruthlessly used it in the 2010 and in the lead up to the 2010 election. In fact, they used it for 3 years, kept saying, "You crashed the economy, you crashed the economy." But actually, when you think now back to what happened in 2008-9 and how the Tories then did also use it to say austerity, 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 and we're now in this dreadful position, because they really did do nothing too much to improve things. And if you think how awful everything was at that time in terms of the global structure, and of course it wasn't the responsibility of the Labour Party, the subprime mortgage catastrophe that happened in America, that was to do with lending decisions that had been made in the States. But I think they don't get enough credit for it. I really don't. Just as I think that if you go back a bit further to the year 2000, there was this big push called Jubilee 2000 to cancel the debt of countries that were still developing and that had been borrowing money to help their development potential. Gordon Brown worked very intensively on that and was, right in the forefront of the group of people who got the world to agree to cancel some of those debts. Now, of course, many of those countries are probably now massively indebted to China. So at some point in the future, either the Chinese will call in the debt in some way or another, or there's going to have to be something similar will have to happen. But I think that Gordon Brown is much underrated. I think he's starting to be better rated now, because the Tories have had their own particular storm with the pandemic, which was none of their creation, just as the global financial crash 2008-09 was not the Labour creation. But of course, Brexit, which was their own creation, and therefore they cannot be forgiven for that. I was at something last night where we were talking about the construction industry. And, in about 10 years' time, unless we do something about massively increasing the number of people willing to go into training and then into construction as a profession, we are going to have nobody left to work in it, because I used to go on building sites and see the signage in English, Polish and Lithuanian, or English, Polish and Bulgarian, or whatever. But of course, the signage is only in one language now, because so many people went home and haven't come back since Brexit.
And of course, some of them were found to be working unsafely, not least during the pandemic.
Well, I wasn't going on to very many building sites during the pandemic. I'd just like to make it clear, I was neither partying at number 10, nor was I going on to building sites. I was working from home and, complying with all the regulations.
And I'm significantly sure, running quite a sizable portion of the country on I'm the sure, quiet, yes.
I'm sure we might come on to talking about the COVID
we
hearing.
Might well do, yes.
I remember Alistair as being incredibly competent, very cool, calm and collected, very, very competent, just so competent, and also a really, really, really nice guy, such a nice person. So, yeah, an incredible loss to everybody, but also obviously to his family. Condolences.
A rare creature indeed. Graham, good morning. We started off talking, as you've probably gathered, about, we haven't gone on to Kissinger yet, if indeed we will, Alistair Darling, and it also waiting in the wings, Shane McGowan. What are your impressions of the 2008 crash and how we got through it and Darling's role in it?
Yeah, I agree with what's been said. He was underrated, I think. He did, with Gordon Brown, they did save the economic system almost, I think.
Sort of economic systems designers, in a way. They're both great thinkers that seem to work in tandem.
Yeah. Well, they ring fence, domestic trading against international trading. And I don't think that's been complied with. And the banking system has edged its way back, I think. In other words, the banks never paid back what the government gave them. So I think that's part of the problem with the financial system as it remains.
So, and you could say, in a sense, it was a sticking plaster because of the non-cooperation of the parties that were being bailed out. Mal, would you agree with that analysis?
Darling was, it's very interesting, I always think, to look at what the political opponents say when someone passes away. And it's been really striking how warm, particularly Alex Salmond and George Osborne, who were Darling's two political opponents over what I guess are the two things he'll be remembered for, which are the stewardship of the economy during the subprime crisis, as we've been talking about, and also leading the campaign against Scottish independence in 2014, when he and George Osborne teamed up to lead that campaign. And in both cases, you know, the Salmon in particular was extremely warm towards him, and saying that he was one of those politicians who would argue ferociously over the issues when they were on a public platform together, but was unfailingly warm and polite, and apparently extremely funny as well in private. And the tributes, because I don't think it was expected. With 70 is no age these days, thank heaven. And I hadn't been aware. I think it was quite a short illness, so it's a bit of a shock, I think, to the whole system. But his everybody that I heard of, I met him. I think it was once. It might have been a couple of times when he was Secretary of State for Industry, because he went on a political journey as a student. By all accounts, he was really on the extreme left. But then, as often happens, You get into office, you start realizing that some of these extreme left themes and shibboleths don't really work, and became what I think would be regarded as far more mainstream Labour. Indeed, he rather took on Gordon Brown when Darling was at the Treasury and Brown was Prime Minister over public spending, and was quite hawkish in keeping a rein on public spending. But another journey he went on was quite anti-nuclear in his youth, but towards very much becoming a side advocate for nuclear power in his time at Trade and Industry and then at the Treasury. So I got to meet him a couple of times through that. And, it was only a couple of professional meetings. But, yeah, I found him enormously impressive, I must say. I say, I never met Henry Kissinger or Shane McGowan, so I can't share any stories on that.
But the gnats quaver away, I suspect. Do you think it's worth, guys, just casting a brief 2020 across world affairs and what Kissinger's sort of influence might have been on where we've got to? Is it a case somewhat of whatever he did having been somewhat undone by subsequent events, or will the legacy last? I'm thinking, for example, of Russia's behaviour recently and the fact that he's credited as being the sort of the progenitor of détente, as it was then called.
Well, yes, I think he was sort of a bit like, there are a few characters. I think Rudy Giuliani might be another one in more recent times.
Yeah.
Who went from enormously positive public profile, Kissinger, as you mentioned, particularly because of his work with Nixon over rapprochement with China, which was really very impressive given the positions at the news there. And of course, he was given the Nobel Peace Prize, although he subsequently said he didn't really deserve it. But very high profile.
Vietnam, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, in his case, through Vietnam. He subsequently there, he there are those who sort of call for him to be war criminals. Owen Jones, who I used to have a lot of time for, but seems to have really lost the plot recently over the situation in the Middle East. But he tweeted saying that Kissinger should have spent his last years in jail, should have been treated as a war criminal. So quite a fall from grace of his public attitude. I think when he came out of politics, he seems, like Giuliani, to have done extremely well for himself as a lawyer and as a consultant. But he made his final visit to China just last month, I think, at the age of 100, really.
Yeah.
Which is pretty impressive. And China, did issue a very warm response to his passing away, which they don't always do to Western politicians.
And also, Vladimir Putin said nice things about him as well. So, I think he. The work that he did on the reintroduction of relationships with China will never go away, but I do think many of the other aspects of his work are, well, highly questionable through to war crimes seems to be the range of views. And obviously he seems to have been very positive about the overthrow of Allende.
In Chile, yes. And I think East Timor as well was mentioned as something where he basically encouraged the opposition to go in. No doubt the CIA had at least more than a passing interest in both of these events. But it's a question of this American hegemony, isn't it? That he was so so wedded to.
I think the figure that really struck me, so whilst Owen Jones might be rather excitable about it, but they actually quoted a figure of saying that in Laos there are still 80 million unexploded pieces of ordnance from where they bombed or mined or whatever it was. I think it was mainly bombing.
80 million.
80 million, which means that there must be people being... I mean, I know there's still quite a lot. I mean, they just found one off the coast of, was it Suffolk or Norfolk recently in the last couple of weeks, because there was a big storm and a road collapsed and various things got washed away. And then they went and did a controlled explosion. So, I mean, obviously it gets littered around all over the place. But yeah, 80 million.
And no humanitarian intervention, Lady Di style, as was to go and sort it out.
No. No, I mean, they're going to have the same problem in Ukraine, I think, as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's going to be huge for years and years and years. There will be parts of Ukraine that will just be full of ordnance.
It's one of the vicious legacies of waging war, really, isn't it? Yeah, indeed, yeah. I suppose in later life, would he have had the capacity, perhaps, for self-reflection? Was he a bit of an old rogue? Graham, what do you think?
I think, was it David Curtis who made a documentary?
Oh, yes. Hmm.
Who blamed him for the whole Middle East problem.
Notwithstanding, having it's thought resolved, at least partially resolved, the Israel-Egypt conflict in about 70, was it the Yom Kippur War?
Well, apparently he made an agreement with Assad.
Mm.
And then went back on it, and that turned us against the West, and it went downhill from there.
Mm.
Including making Gaddafi agree to become a terrorist or something.
Is Kissinger the essential architect of the way in which Israel is wedded to to America in terms of, you know, defense contracts and special relationships and that sort of thing? Indeed, special relationships in general. Is that a sort of Kissinger conceit?
Well, he made that terrible comment about we needn't worry about Syria fighting Iran because they're both killing each other. You know?
I suppose, I mean, some would have it, and I suppose it's just something that is, you often hear on the left of Owen Jones, etc., is that it's somebody's interest for the world to be perpetually at war somewhere, because, you know, there's money to be made and there's, I suppose, diplomatic and industrial gains to be had and so forth, if you back one side or the other. But so in a sense, that became, in national security, actually, that became Kissinger's sort of domain, didn't it, really? I mean, somebody who made for himself a backroom position into something of considerable power and influence.
Yeah, it is a military industrial complex, not a peace industrial complex.
Hmm. Am I right in saying that, Leonie Mao? I mean,
it's a very 1984 comment, though, isn't it? You know, there will always be war going on somewhere or the other. If Oceania is not at war with Eurasia, then etc. etc. And also, it seems to be a Vladimir Putin thing as well, doesn't it? To kind of maintain your approach and to distract the people, you need to find new targets that you can go to war with all the time. The most recent one in Russia this week has been the invention and the banning in court, which is a bit weird, of the International Lesbian and Gay promotion campaign or some completely invented campaign that obviously doesn't exist.
I thought it was going to be the successor to the Sinclair C5, but clearly not.
Well, I don't know that they've necessarily banned that in Russia, but we can make Andy, if you're interested.
Yeah.
You know, yes, I mean, always being at war or having that distraction of a foreign activity that, you know, you can throw red meat to your populace. I don't know. It's very sad, really, that should be part of the way things are run, that there always has to be a war going on somewhere.
Or indeed some kind of internal division. I mean, I always think that's a sign of can be a sign of political desperation or panic, you know, when you have to create the enemy within.
Mm.
Or without, I think.
Or indeed, quite, yeah. That's a curious one, Mal. I mean, is that perhaps a misstep for Putin?
Sorry, in what sense?
Well, apparently the fact that there's been an acknowledgement and a banning of LGBT rights within the week, apparently, in Russia.
I don't know. I mean, we don't know. It depends how it plays out with the Russian public. I'm worried, I must say, that we're moving back towards a world where you do make more votes by attacking various groups than you do by being inclusive. I mean, clearly the Jewish community is the one that's really under the cosh at the moment in terrible ways. So you're seeing
Habering in Russia, I guess,
it always has in Russia with the pogroms and the like. But there was a period in the world when we were moving away from that kind of thing. And of course, as they often say, you know, anti-Semitism is the kind of canary in the mine that rises in anti-Semitism are almost always followed by rises in attacks on other minorities, including lesbians and gays. So it's worrying, but maybe not surprising given the atmosphere in the world at the moment. But we're seeing countries feeling emboldened to do this. And yeah, frankly, when I think for me the most shocking news of the week, actually, I mean, I wouldn't want to. There's been so much really shocking news that it's difficult to say that. But the thing that really made me gave me a jolt of saying this is way out was Havering Council's decision to cancel Hanukkah celebrations, in effect simply giving in to Muslim extremists. And the Muslim Council of Britain has condemned it. Many Muslims are saying, so you're telling us that we Muslims can't be trusted to mark and celebrate and be completely comfortable with another faith, in this case the Jewish faith, expressing its faith in the way that we express ours. But it just seemed to me to be the most dreadful example of cowardice and bowing down to a perceived, I think, small minority of Muslims who might cause trouble about this, rather than saying every faith has it, you know, we're going to celebrate faith like we always have, and anybody who breaks the law around that will be severely dealt with. So there is a, you know, combination of official cowardice in some cases, and certainly officialdom not standing up for rights. And with, you know, some elements of the Conservative Party talking about pulling out of the UN, of the European Human Rights Court. Now, Russia pulled out of that some time ago, but at least while we were all together, we were in a position to condemn that. We may not have even been in a terribly strong position to condemn it in the near future.
I suppose Havering, if cornered about this, would say, well, we're doing this to preserve a public calm and so forth. But effectively, I suppose what your argument might be, Mal, please correct me if I'm wrong here, is that basically this is cultural suppression. It would be unlikely that Eid or Diwali would be banned in the same way. And this is saying that maybe there is something signal about even something as benign and wonderful as Hanukkah, you know, the candles lit for humanity in general. It is deemed a sort of its presence to be a bit of a dog whistle.
Well, there's about 300,000.
Only wonderful house. I didn't mean it in that sense.
There's about 300,000 Jews in the UK. There's about 4 million Muslims, and I guess that, you know, councils that don't have a, you know, Havering showing themselves just not having a moral compass around this, probably just do the calculations and say, okay, yeah, but Havering is a peculiar. It's led by the residents' associations again, I think, at the moment. Mm. To be fair, Andrew Rossendale, the local MP, has written very strongly to the council, as have many people condemning this dreadful decision.
A lot of refugees out there, I think. London displaced refugees, if I remember right. And there's somebody in a place called Orkinde, which is a little way from it, but not far.
Yeah, I mean, although it's now part of London, it feels, I did a bit of work there once, yeah, for peer review, and it feels like it, really like an Essex district council in many ways. It's right on the edge of London, and very rural. You know, some lovely countryside around there. Mm. But I don't know, I mean, you have calculations. You have the Jews, in some people's eyes, they're not a proper minority anyway, because they seem to be rather good at looking after themselves, so they don't become clients of the state. And there's not that many of them compared to Muslims, so their rights can be ignored. But of course, that doesn't stop with one minority. Once you embolden people, seeing officialdom bowing down to threats of violence against one minority, then it doesn't buy them off by any means. It just tends to encourage it.
I wonder, Leo, Graham, if you think this cultural censorship is a worry. Is it also worth throwing into the mix the sort of election of Geert Wilders in Holland, who's avowedly anti-Islamic and wants to basically close down all the mosques, hopefully not burn them down, but and just politely escort people elsewhere. And yet this seems very unlikely to happen because he's going to have to make a coalition probably with parties of the left, with the tacit support of the previous incumbents and people like that. But could it happen at Havering? But this general issue of, you know, cultural censorship with a new broom.
Well, I would imagine that...
It's counterproductive.
Yeah. Mm.
Because Israel has started the war again in Gaza, apparently, this morning.
2.0, yeah.
So I think that's the big clash with Biden. You know, what is Biden going to do now? Blinken has warned them quite directly, almost directly. But they're going ahead. So it's going to be extremely indicative of how the relation between America and Israel.
Well, the relationship between Biden and Netanyahu wasn't that good anyway. I don't think he'd invited him to visit him in Camp David or anything like that since he's been the president. I don't think Netanyahu... Has he been to the States at all since Biden came in as the president?
I think... Was there a brief visit in the very early days, a sort of cursory hello when Biden got the gig?
He met the Knesset and addressed the Knesset. And he made a very good speech, and he said exactly what the situation was, and
international law, clearly, all that.
With Ben-Gavir and so on, and they've had the People's March, where they ended up screaming at each other in the Knesset. So I think the political situation is changing in Israel.
Oh, I think it already started to change since the last election because of the outrageous proposals that Netanyahu had been coming forward with. But the point that I was making was that, yes, Biden has addressed the Knesset more recently since this situation developed on the 7th of October. But I don't think full sort of diplomatic courtesies and niceties have been extended to Netanyahu, because I don't think Biden has ever particularly been a huge fan of, well, certainly not of Netanyahu's government in its current formation, in bed with all these Ben-Gavir and other extremists. So I think they were probably coming from a slightly stronger position than some previous American presidents to be fairly strenuous with the Israelis, as indeed as no one else could be. But I think Blinken didn't say you can't restart the war. What he said was you cannot continue it in the same way, and you must do much more to ensure that civilians are not being hit. Because I don't know whether the figure from, because it's Hamas that provides this figure of 14 thousands, and nobody really knows if that's true, but I mean the level of bombing is such that it's hard to believe that it isn't, or something similar to that.
Well, that's good, isn't it, that you're a very modern war machine, so you should be able to do it in a different way than car bombing the whole place.
The argument that they're using, which is there's tunnels underneath everything, then that is a difficult thing to eradicate, but go in there on the ground and do it. Don't just, drop bombs from the sky, which I think is sort of roughly what the Americans have been saying to them. But no, it's a terrible situation. And if it has restarted, then that's, it's an absolute tragedy. And there also seems to have been some problems. It isn't just Hamas, which I think we sort of heard a bit earlier, because the Israelis had said that a bomb that hit a previous hospital had been fired by Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And now it turns out that Hamas didn't even have all of the hostages that Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and other fragments. Plus, also, it sounded like some people went on a nice day trip, just individuals. He turned up with a motorbike and waltzed off with the people on the, tied to the back of their motorbike. I mean, it all just sounds just completely... impossible.
Yeah, anarchic almost, really. In sort of perhaps in a sort of deracinating way, if that's the word. Mal, do you think that Netanyahu is holding out for a possible Trump victory in 2024, or do you think he'll be gone sooner rather than later after Blinken's shining and Biden's shining?
I mean, quite apart from all the issues about how he was, eroding important rights before the October 7th atrocities, he's also going to come in for a lot of scrutiny over how unprepared Israel and his leadership was for that attack. They seem to be reasonably proficient at dealing with missiles coming across from Hamas terror from Gaza Strip, which of course, as we all knew would be the case, the Hamas authorities haven't seen any particular reason why they should stop military activities just because there's a ceasefire or a pause has been declared. And they found a technological solution to deal with that, this dome that picks off most weapons. Nothing's 100% efficient. But the very slow response of the Israeli armed forces to the atrocities is bound to come under a lot of questioning.
Not
that people
the
said they
pace. Yeah, yeah. Mm.
They called the authorities and they didn't come. Well, you kind of expect that, given all of the rhetoric from Hamas over many, many years, Hamas has never hidden the fact that it wants to mutilate and eliminate Jews wherever it possibly can. For Israel to have been so caught off guard by this, I think there are real questions there about Netanyahu's competence, quite apart from all of the other criticisms of his attitude. And the other thing that is, I think, very worrying is what's going on in the West Bank and the apparent... I think the strong cynics would say that almost under cover of the Hamas attack, Israelis are expanding their operations in the West Bank and displacing more of the people from their homes there. So there's some really, really big questions about that. Now I have no idea whether it'll survive or not. It seems to have survived pretty effectively up to this stage, but it's unfortunate, I think, that his leadership has coincided with this increase in the Hamas's unspeakably awful attacks, I think they, in a weird sort of way, just as leaders generally do quite well when their countries are attacked, their popularity tends to go up. in a very
they bank awful, on it sometimes, don't they? Yeah,
and in a really, really awful kind of way, as is sadly so often the case. The two extremes kind of flourish off each other and rely on each other, and because it shores up their base at home.
Mm. But I suppose that kind of points up the fact that there has to be an after plan. There has to be a recovery strategy for both parties. Sorry, I interrupted. Graham, were you coming in?
I think it's one of the first examples. The military failure of Israeli defense was the first example of what happens if you hand everything over to AI.
You see that, don't you? If you look at the official video to the Israeli Song of Hope, it's an old song that they've revived as the sort of rallying campaign for the thing. You see this technology at play.
And yeah.
It's quite sort of celebrated. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's even wider than that, because now China has come forward put a peace plan forward and saying that Israel should have a roadmap to the two-state solution. So Biden is up against China saying, well, we're going to sort out the situation and take over the sort of the policing role of internationally.
And perhaps they offer their own armaments as part of the deal to either side or both.
Yeah, saying it's part of the decline of the West is the failure of America.
There's a thought.
The Chinese think, isn't it? I mean, they're persuading the whole of Africa that they should
with financial inducements. Yes.
Well, they should get back their own back for colonialism.
It goes back to what Leone was saying about Gordon Brown and the cancellation of debt in the third world, doesn't it? Earlier on, yes.
Yeah, and apparently Saudi Arabia has got a plan to sell internal combustion engines to Africa to keep the, they call it sustainable oil program.
perhaps not unrelated to the sort of questions hanging over the UAE chairmanship of COP28, I believe.
Well, exactly. I mean, he's...
But they can hold their heads high, can't they? Yep, yeah.
He's banned criticism of the oil industry, I think, apparently. I don't think he's going to get away with that, though.
Well, it'd be a rather short conference otherwise, wouldn't it? But again, fossil fuels loom, don't they?
Well, it's going to be very interesting what our king says this morning, isn't it?
God, he's got some eggshells to tread on, hasn't he? Would you like to comment on that, COP28 looming?
Well, I mean, it's definitely going to come out like... Gaza has shown the horrible things that Israel army are doing. COP is going to show how everyone is backsliding across the world. I mean, but the only good news is that apparently the installation rate is on an exponential curve for renewables. So it's difficult to stop now. But I think there's going to be an awful lot of investors losing their money on fossil, because apparently there's, is it $2.7 trillion investment in oil since the Paris Agreement? Mm. Something like that.
Off beam here, but you've got me thinking about Private Walker and Dad's Army and they're supplying essentials when no other route was available. And if you're going to... If you spend a lot of money on a war, you're going to need resources like that, aren't you, to get to shore things up on both sides.
The renewable aspect to rebuilding Gaza. You know, it could be built like Mazda as a renewable city.
For whom, I suppose, is the question, isn't it? Yeah. Leone Mal, would you like to chime in with us? And the environmental backwash effect of these huge conflicts and COP28.
Well, is Private Walker the one who used to open his jacket and he used to have lots of watches?
That's the one, yes, yeah. And he knew where to get his hands on a jerry can occasionally.
Or indeed a pair of ladies' tights.
Indeed, yes. Yeah, well, the carburetor, of course, yeah.
or indeed anything else that you might need. I think it's an ensemble cast. We're all just incredibly funny, weren't they?
Gloriously so, yeah.
Yes. Arthur Lowe. He was the master of the one-liner.
Or Napoleon, as he was occasionally called by the ARP.
The withering look and his ongoing round. The vicar. He hated the vicar for some reason. I've got no idea why.
All town enmities in a nutshell, really, wasn't it? It still lives. Yeah.
He could definitely the kind of person who could have a fight with himself.
Yeah.
Arthur Lowe. But no, I mean, well, COP28 has already started. I'm supposed to be attending it, but in this wonderful world that we live in, I am going to be beamed in via Zoom or Teams into a discussion on Wednesday. And I think the theme, the global stocktake, is quite an interesting one, sort of trying to, I'll be sort of talking about the sort of the regional angle and the city angle. With my assembly member hat on and sort of saying, you know, are we doing enough at the sort of the regional and at the city level with other luminaries. I'm not actually quite sure who else is speaking in my session with me. So I'm probably...
Well, you'll be a hard act to follow.
I probably ought to find out. So it's going to be very, very odd getting beamed into a conference where I've not done that before. So that'll be a whole new thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can only hope that the stock take shows that there is some positive work coming through everywhere. I mean, I do think we're at a very low point at the moment, and things have been incredibly difficult because El Nino has switched to its other mode. So, you know, the heating possibility, you know, things that have been going on this year and the likelihood
of this and that, yeah,
they're probably going to have 7 or 8 years of it being pretty awful, I think, actually, in terms of you know, what the weather does. But they were also saying on the news this week that China may have reached peak fossil use and has been really going full steam ahead to switch its economy over from that, which would be amazing if it does peak and start to reduce. And I think my biggest fear is of a Trump win, and at the moment that does seem to be quite a possibility, although I think he's facing 98 indictments or some ridiculous number of charges that he's facing in various courts in the
world. One somebody's lost more, I think, yeah, so far.
So, you know, whether he's allowed to be on the ballot paper or not is an entirely different question. Although someone did say, but you can still become the president even if you have been put in jail for a huge, vast number of crimes and misdemeanors, which I think the Americans do need. The Republican Party
could pass notes out, couldn't they? Yeah.
You know, the Republican Party really do need to think about what kind of look is that for America to have their president languishing in a jail cell if that came to pass. But no, I think, you know, we have to hope that some of the work that's being done by countries like China and elsewhere is starting to pay off, and that where people were talking about actually making 2030 the year when they start to move towards net zero. I mean, I don't think that's going to happen, but I think the sense of urgency of trying to do it by 2030 is a good idea. Rather than saying, oh, we can make 2050 the year when we need to achieve it and we've still got oodles of time, because we haven't got oodles of time. It's quite obvious. We really do need to be getting a wriggle on. And I keep hearing things about carbon capture and storage in relation to, for example, most of London's rubbish is burnt in incinerators, which obviously contributes. So, you know, can they actually capture the carbon from the burning in the incinerators and, you know, then take it? I think they're talking about burying it in the North Sea. I mean, I thought all of these technologies were still at a sort of relatively early stage, but we are, you know, that along with reducing simply the amount of carbon that's released into the atmosphere, you know, we've got to be pressing all the buttons and going down all the routes. It's not just about more renewables. In some cases, it will be about just simply using less resources and we've been very bad in this country. You know, we've got the leakiest buildings in Europe. So, you know, there's a huge amount of insulation is needed.
Notwithstanding Graham's fine influence, yes, yeah.
I mean, if you
well, the roofs they completely ignored.
Yeah, well, yes, indeed.
If you go to Europe, yeah. You know, and it could be because we're an island and Europe is obviously a much larger continent. So in the centre of the continent, it gets a lot colder. But, you know, I remember going to Germany when I was about 13 or 14 and discovering that absolutely everybody in the area where I was staying had external roller shutters that came down over the windows.
Oh, yes, I remember them, yeah.
The outside of the house. And they're a much better way of keeping the heat in at night in your home than, you know, the kind of, well, curtains, which is mainly what people in this country just use on the inside. So, you know, we don't, shutters or and shading is going to be even more important in the summer. You know, most countries have, you know, have a proper approach to shading buildings. Last topic is architectural you know, design feature that everybody loves, which is massive great windows. I think we've now got buildings all over London that are going to suffer from overheating.
I think they've been attempts to twitch these external roller blind things, but you can't twitch them the way you can twitch curtains, which I think causes problems in suburbia.
That would
much
cause
slower process.
Mrs. Trellis of North Wales probably
indeed
would not approve. I think you're right, Andy, but you know that was So much to do. But I'm really hoping that the global stocktake this week at COP28 shows that there are some green shoots here and there at the very least. That's what I'm hoping for.
So it was behind Starmer's voting against the planning act that the government were putting through, wasn't it? Forcing or not for enforcing the implementation of blue-green or SUDS technology on new buildings. And I think that's something that will develop in the future, is this conflict between the planning desire to get houses built and to change the law so they have to be to include renewable energy and
is that within your scope and your address, Leonie, that sort of thing, in terms of urban architecture?
Well, to a certain degree, because the London Plan 2021 is something that was came out in draft and then went through lots of consultation, and I participated in the what's called the examination in public, the EIP, of the London Plan, which took 5 months between January and May 2019. And I went along and spoke at that extensively on many of the matters relating to I Know How to Live. That's all I'm saying. And of course, it's incredibly detailed and you have to submit it all in planning language. But I'm pleased to say that some of the things that I'd been promoting in that report that I did of my own, the one on biodiversity in housing developments, biodiversity in new developments, which had introduced the concepts of biodiversity net gain. Not only did that get into the London Plan, the government is just about to include biodiversity net gain from the beginning of 2024 into the national planning policy framework. So, builders. All builders everywhere, all developers will be expected to include it. And we also, I also had the urban greening factor in that my own report, which is also in the London Plan as the London greening factor. So small things like that now are finding their ways into, I mean, they're not small, I mean, they're kind of small expressions, but they have a huge impact. And they, of course, as the boroughs around London rewrite their local plans, they must always be in conformity with the London Plan. So now in the Wandsworth local plan, which was adopted in its new form in July 2023, now has two clauses in it, LP55 and LP56, which relate to many of these concepts. And when we were looking at the Wimbledon Stadium application in the Planning Applications Committee, which was only last week, I had to go and sit at the back because I've spoken in favour of preserving nature and against very large a very large stadium flattening parts of Wimbledon Park, so I wasn't allowed to participate. But of course, there was a whole section in the reports that was being considered by the committee that used all of these concepts that I'd worked very hard to get into the London plan, and there were the Wandsworth planning officers talking about them in the Wandsworth Planning Applications Committee. So that did feel very positive, but that's not to say that the next iteration of the plan couldn't include much more, and couldn't include many more positive things about sort of blue green and sustainable urban drainage and all of the things that I know that Graham has also been promoting. But it's just a question of moving them all forward, because some of these things, of course, will also address the you know, first they'll deal with the consequences of the climate emergency. So very extreme rainfall incidents where a massive quantity of rain falls in a very short period of time does tend to overwhelm.
That's what we just had, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, yeah, we've had two or three of them actually during September and October. I just visited the Malden sewage treatment works, and they've got these massive empty spaces there that when there are these massive influxes of rain, so all these tanks fill up, but of course there is a, you know, there's a limit to how much they can hold on to, and then of course that's when you get these sewer overflows into the rivers. So the more that we can do to slow down the water as it rushes towards into the drains and into Thames Water's hands, I was going to say, but I don't think I want to use the word hands.
But... Yes, no, let's not mention Leanne's again. No, sorry.
But that's what we need to do. We need to, you know, stop the water from moving so quickly. Mm-hmm. So allowing everybody to pave over their front gardens and having roads that are just, you know, impermeable surfaces doesn't help with all of that. But, you know, so it's all that sort of mitigation and adaptation that we need to be thinking about, as well as doing all of these other things like, you know, overall reducing our actual energy use and then reducing our fossil energy use. So so many things that you know, all of these things fit together as a piece. But the London plan is there at the moment to sort of guide what we're doing across the whole of London.
Mal, thank you. Yes, can I ask Mal to come in there? Sorry. Thank you for being so patient with that long, I think, essential discourse. What's your impression of the prospects for Leone's, I think, fine contribution there, and also the Chinese influence that appears to be sort of slowly accruing, perhaps not so slowly, around the developing countries, and the ability for them to shore things up, albeit at a considerable rate of interest?
It's not taken quite a good idea. Last year, figures came out showing that we use more coal in the year in 2022 than any year in history. The oil in 2022 was only the second highest ever in history because of we're not quite through the COVID epidemic yet, but very clear that oil is going to go over the, or it looks very clear that oil is going to go over the 100 billion barrels a year for the first time in 2023. It'd be a peak. Natural gas its highest year so far was 2021, but it's projected to grow at something like 1.5-2% over the course of the next decade. And this is, we had the UN Framework of Convention on Climate Change. It was known as the Rio Convention in 1992. That set 1990 as the base year for measuring these things. We're producing something like 70% more carbon per year now than we were in 1990 as a globe. And the latest COP will go, I've no reason to see why, having done it nearly 30 times before, this COP will be any different from the others. There'll be a lot of warm words and an agreement at the end of the day, which is pretty close to what the world would be doing anyway with technological change. There's a massive incentive at the moment to move away from gas because of the situation in Ukraine. The likelihood that Russia is not going to be acceptable as a major gas producer for quite a while now. So there's big technological pressure to move there. We've got this huge nuclear renaissance globally. Wind is in a huge amount of difficulty. I mean, Siemens, which is in many ways the technology company you would think of in the energy business for decades, lost $5 billion in the States because of the that you just can't make money out of wind. It's extremely expensive to produce, but people have fallen for the myth that it's the cheapest source around. So governments have said, okay, if you're the cheapest source, we'll give you less money. And they say, no, we're only cheap as long as you give us all this money. You know, we're only competitive as long as we continue to get the subsidies. And
yeah, that's the funny thing, Malcolm.
We're seeing huge cancellations of offshore wind projects, particularly in the States, but in Europe as well at the moment.
It's a kind of blackmail.
Is there a better economic model out there for this, Glenn?
Well, it's the kind of blackmail by the industry saying we're not going to build it unless we can make more profit by you giving us subsidies. So they're just going for the subsidies.
Well, no, companies don't turn their back on something which is going to make a lot of money in those circumstances. The reason that
they can make a lot more money.
Unless you're going to claim that Siemens was actually falsifying its accounts when it announced this $5 billion loss. And there is a further problem that wind, the blades don't tend to work. They've had huge problems with the mechanisms for the wind, which has meant a lot of lawsuits from the purchasers of wind farms because they don't work terribly well. And I can understand why renewables were massively oversold. They're a multinational, multi-billion industry. And why should they tell the truth any more than any other multi-billion industry tells the truth? But it is really coming back to bite them at the moment. And China is very interesting. The Chinese nuclear industry is a model. We have about half of the reactors under construction in the world at the moment are in China, and they're building them to time and cost. They're getting them up in less than 5 years. And then it's a project which is going to generate electricity for 80 years after that. There are real lessons to learn about project management.
Well, I think the Chinese are taking the economic advantage. So they know that they can make more money out of renewables than they can out of fossil. So I
guess it's how the economy is set up there, isn't it? What they can subsidize and command and control.
I just made
I think China, it's
a
not. Video it, for, well, you say, you, let's be clear. Chinese use of coal is massively increasing year on year.
Not tipping point, as has been elsewhere suggested.
But they're developing the technologies and
it's slowing,
cleaning up on their solar energy.
Right.
Market.
Well, what they have recognised is that they're gambling on the gravy train for renewables in the West continuing because they'll be in a very strong position. And in particular, of course, many of the solar panels that we use in the West are produced by slave labour in China, which is why their cost came down very significantly. And China has very close to a stranglehold on the rare earths, the praseodymiums, the neodymiums, others that are essential for wind. And China is positioning itself to be sort of Russia in spades when it comes to a stranglehold over the global wind industry. So China has enormous...
The West hasn't been planning for it.
Well, coupled with the fact that you don't find these elements in the West because it just so happens... that the enormous deposits are in China. That's just an accident of geology. But we don't have major reserves of these rare earths in particularly in Europe, but even in the States, which has a very varied geology. But they don't. Yeah, the most of the world's production of these essential rare elements for wind are in China. So China, of course, is pushing forward on this because it's another position where it can get to being able to hold the rest of the world to ransom.
So we have all this, gentlemen, but we have the excellent ripple effect of Leonie Cooper and her keynote address to look forward to, which has cut through quite a lot of this. Thank you all very much for now. Have a great weekend.
Just a quick word on the by-election.
Yes, I thought that might happen.
By-election.
Sorry, what was I thinking of?
I mean, not some Sean Berry. Leonie's colleague at County Hall, who has been selected as the Green candidate for Brighton Pavilion to take over from Caroline Lucas, who's declared the country's one Green MP, who said she's going to stand down at next year's election. So she vacated her Highgate seat, and the Greens held on there very comfortably. But and Labour held on to a seat in County Durham, as you'd frankly as you'd expect. But the really interesting ones in North Yorkshire. Now, in my brought up in North Yorkshire.
Yeah.
It was about as conservative as you could get. North Yorkshire. It was, and yet at the moment the council it's become a unitary council. Recently, so when I was young, there was Scarborough Borough Council that covered a lot of the East Coast up as far as Whitby, and a collection of other of these district councils which were responsible for rubbish collection and leisure and housing locally. But they sat under North Yorkshire County Council, which was responsible for things like the roads and education and social care, the big ticket items. But like a lot of areas of the country, they've moved towards what's called a unitary authority, where there's a single council covering all of those activities. The London boroughs are pretty similar to that, although we do have the mayor sitting above them for some functions. And North Yorkshire, in its last elections in 2022, that was the first time it sat as was elected as a unitary authority. So one council looking after all those functions. It was assumed it would be Tory forevermore. Tories just scraped home in 2022, but then there have been resignations and by-elections that have gone against them. And it's now hung with the Tories having 50 of the 100 seats. And Sowerby, which is a nice rural part of North Yorkshire, had always been conservative. But the Greens just picked the Conservatives for the seat. It's a one-member ward in 2022. The Green, unfortunately for health reasons, had to stand down. And the by-election was extraordinary. The Lib Dems hadn't stood at the last election because there'd been, an informal agreement in terms of tactical voting. Lib Dems did stand this time and just swept the board. The Green vote went down from 50-odd percent to 16%. Lib Dems were elected on if you just do it as a swing from Green to Lib Dem, which never worked when one hasn't stood, but it was nearly a 40% swing. The Tories reduced to about a quarter of the vote. That's only the second time that the Greens have lost a by-election to the Lib Dems, certainly in kind of living memory, the other one being in Hampton in Richmond last year, or the year before, 2021, I think it was. So, but what was very funny was the Green literature saying, a vote for Lib Dems is a vote for the Conservatives, vote yellow, get blue. And I don't know why these political parties, particularly the Greens and Lib Dems, do this with their posters. The others do as well. Have produced a graph from quite spurious non-comparable areas and say, there you are, you can't win. And the electors go and say, oh, that's your attitude, is it? You just watch. And the Lib Dems, who couldn't win this seat, and a vote for them will be the Tories, are now celebrating another seat on North Yorkshire Council. So it's an interesting, I guess worrying for the Greens there as to how far their vote collapsed. And whether that might be connected with some of the antics the Greens have been getting up with, they seem to have become a repository for the extreme anti-Semitic Labour left. They seem far more interested in issues of gender identity than they do in the environment at the moment.
I think with the Honourable Shanghai section, with that sort of thing, can't you? Yes,
And I don't know. Maybe it's affecting their vote. Maybe. A lot of Green voters saying we actually want a party that cares about the environment, not something that's going to go off in these crazy directions.
Well, but,
single by-election, you can't say much, but it's interesting.
Is it? Any thoughts, guys?
Yeah, maybe it's a vote for Lib Dems on the hope that they'll revoke Brexit.
Well, Vandalia and all that, we might come back to that next time. Indeed, yes. We goofed, did we?
Well,
yes.
We'll have to leave that dangling there.
How will that go down in Sowerby? Yeah. Thank you all very much. Have a lovely weekend.
And cheers. You guys.
Cheers.